All right, I'm going to go ahead and get started. I'm going to talk through the brief. I encourage you to, rather than putting on pause or on mute today, if you want to just jump in and ask any questions as we go along, that would be great, and we can have a bit more of a discussion than we have when we have a larger group on the line. So. All right, so for the audio editor, we'll start about here. I want to thank everybody for being part of the lunchtime learning. This will be the call for the month of May in 2011, and the last call before a short hiatus over the summer, and we start our new every other month schedule. So we're going to start doing at the same Monday noon time, lunchtime learning at noon 1 month, and then the following month we'll do building books. So that way there'll just be one financial education call per month, and we'll alternate every month between a lunchtime learning topic, which is sort of a hot topic of the day or a topic that people are interested in, and a building books topic, which is a topic that we repeat every year. So we'll have basically six core modules and building books that we'll cover over the course of a year, spaced out every other month. And in the intervening months, we'll do lunchtime learning on the hot topic of the day. So that new schedule starts in August, and we hope everybody will be able to tune in then in that regular series. But today, we're going to stick with our lunchtime learning format. I'll go over a brief, which has been posted on the fyi.uwex.edu/financial-series website. This one is called Getting Back on Your Feet, and it's a PDF, which is about 4 pages in length and just sort of goes over some of the issues that you might confront as a financial educator or a counselor when dealing with clients who are getting back on their financial feet, so to speak, after a foreclosure, after a bankruptcy, or after a sort of other negative financial event. Unfortunately, this is a very common predicament for families to be in today after the Great Recession of 2008-9. Wisconsin still is facing elevated foreclosure rates and bankruptcy rates and unemployment rates. So there's lots of people who are still in the midst of dealing with unemployment, income shocks, expenditure shocks, foreclosure, all these negative events that people are recovering from. I think the main messages I would encourage you to think about as educators are that, you know, when people come in these situations, they really do have hope. They want things to get better. And there is evidence that it can get better, that their financial future can be secure, that they can get out from under debt and from collection calls and from all the other financial stresses that are confronting them. But it's not easy. And, you know, the limited evidence we have so far suggests in past recessions, it's been hard. It's been hard for people to get back on track. And, you know, at least preliminary evidence suggests that this go-around might be harder than past ones, that the struggles that families are going to have given the current lack of employment, income growth are going to make things that much tougher, combined with generally less access to credit in this particular recovery as compared to other recoveries. So before I get going, are there any questions? All right. So I'm basically going to follow the format of the brief and the topics that are covered here, but I'm happy to answer questions as they come along, or also have some discussion at the end about what this all might mean. You know, as you think about a client who approaches you who has just gone through a bankruptcy or a foreclosure, or now back at work after a spell of unemployment, there's a reason why they've come into your office, and it's generally because they, like I said before, they have some hope. They want things to get better. And one of the main ways that you can help people in these situations is to help them come up with realistic goals. Many people come out of these predicaments saying, I'll never do that again. I want to learn from my mistakes. I want to, you know, do things right, get back on my feet. And they set goals which are oftentimes just too audacious, too difficult, maybe not specific enough. Maybe they don't hold themselves to, standards that they really need to be able to make progress in the future. So I would say if there's one thing that's really critical, it's helping people be really thoughtful and mindful about setting goals that are realistic and that are time-bound, that are specific, so that they can begin to get back on their feet again. And, you know, I think for it's a balancing act, because you want people to have hope and to you know, think for that big goal of, you know, being able to buy a home or whatever it is that they want to do. But also be real specific that in the short run, really we've got to work on getting this debt paid down or take care of any judgments, those kinds of things. So it's definitely a balancing act to take that hope and put it to use to get some useful things done. But clearly setting goals is key, and helping people think through goals and make sure those goals are specific and measurable, and even helping them stay accountable to those goals. For example, by checking back in with them and seeing where they're at going forward. You know, obviously the number one thing that a family probably has to deal with is income, making sure they have stable income. That might be a combination of public assistance, say SNAP food assistance or other assistance, and earned income, or it might be all earned income. This might include trying to find second jobs, third jobs, having spouses return to work, even getting support from family. But, you know, ultimately that's the key thing, is to find some stable source of income and to build a budget around an income that's reasonable and realistic. Not the dream income, but the actual income that people are going to be able to pull in on a monthly basis on a regular sort of stable way. Once we know how much is coming in, then we can start to think about what's going out. And that involves, you know, the basic task of setting up a budget, thinking about what bills are unpaid, what are those fixed expenses like rent or a car payment, and then what are those debts or those bills that are really most vital. So if not paying the credit card bill or only paying the minimum on the credit card bill just means that you pay a little more interest, that might be an acceptable trade-off. If not paying the car loan bill means that you can't get a car that gets you to work. So helping people make some choices about those kinds of things. Not that we're suggesting people don't pay their bills, but there has to be some prioritization. And, you know, if they can get by paying a minimum on a credit card bill and that allows them to keep the car and therefore keep the income, then that's probably a useful trade-off. Setting the budget or a spending plan is at the core of recovery from any of these events. If it's somebody coming out of foreclosure, then they have to readjust to a new budget with a new housing payment level, perhaps paying for utilities, perhaps dealing with other things that maybe they weren't accustomed to paying for before, like maybe parking or trash removal, that kind of thing. For bankruptcy, I mean, that's obviously a big part of what debtor education has been about, is helping people set up a budget with their new spending level. In some ways, bankruptcy is a little easier to recover from because it has these built-in mechanisms and it sets up payment plans. You know, bankruptcy of this trifecta of job loss, foreclosure and bankruptcy. Bankruptcy may be one of the better structured systems to be exiting from. Obviously, rebuilding credit is a major priority for people. It's hard to have gone through any of these negative financial events and not have really destroyed your credit record in the process. So people may have begun with credit scores that were in the 600s or high 600s and now have credit scores in the low 600s or 500s. And, you know, it makes it very difficult to get credit. Those credit reports might be used for getting a job or getting an apartment. So rebuilding a credit is typically something that people who are aware of their credit and have checked their credit want to work on. And that's typically the second priority. The third priority might be around savings. Savings is difficult for this population. It's not always clear that it should be the first priority. It's something that people are interested in, however. I mean, they want to make sure they don't fall into the pitfalls before. And, you know, I think that you could find certainly people in the personal finance education world who would argue that savings is a non-starter. We shouldn't be going there for this population. But I think it is good to include some level of savings, in part because we know that savings is a habit, it's a behavior. And if we build it in, even in a small way in the beginning, it might help people start to get into a habit that then over time does start to help them accrue an emergency savings account so that when a negative event happens in the future, they have some protection on that. So thinking about each of these tasks, setting a budget, I mean, you all know a lot more about how to work with clients on a set budget. You know that there's 100 different ways to do a budget or to do a spending plan. I think part of it is to help families understand that it's an important tool. So some of what you do is just sell this, not only as a as an exercise that they do once with you, but that they do on a regular basis. You know, this idea of it's a dashboard that lets you know sort of how you're doing, if you're overheating the engine or not, if you're going too fast, if you're going too slow, that kind of thing. And I think it also helps people understand whether their income's going to make ends meet. So it's an important task to teach, not just as a one-time event, but as an ongoing behavior that people sort of get forced into. One thing that's important when you're talking about budgeting with a population that's just faced a setback is that they may feel like they've just sacrificed a lot. They had to give up a car, they had to give up cable, they had to give up all those extras. And maybe they just went down to a really basic budget of, you know, food and housing and, you know, minimum transportation and probably minimum food and in fact on that, you know, no more food out, no more those kinds of things. And so once they get back to work and, you know, particularly if they have kids, it's like, well, we sort of had this lean time, now we want to jump back in again. And that's normal. That's part of what the rewards are of getting back on your feet again. And so we don't want to tell people that's wrong to you know, have a few splurges. But the question is how intentional that is. And if we can help them build that into their spending plan and, you know, not make it a drag on their ability to recover. So, you know, that I think we need to focus people on the smallest of items, on the items that they really feel like give them great happiness, and, you know, encourage them to limit that spending as much as possible so they can otherwise stick to their plan. For some people, it may be too much to even open that door, and maybe the best strategy actually is more sticking to an austerity budget, the sort of monastic kind of budget. And I think that's fine, but it's, you know, it can be hard for you to know who's who. And maybe you know, you could just size people up and get a sense of, you know, who really needs the cold turkey approach and who could do deal with a little bit of incentive here and there. But really do be flexible in how you think about that, and don't just assume that people should always just, you know, cut it down to the bone, but that rather there might be some room for some extras in there. And like I said before, I think it's important to have some room for a little bit of savings, but the goal oftentimes on these budgets is to pay down debt and focus on the debt that's the highest cost debt or the debt that might be the most problematic. So high cost debt might be a credit card. You know, getting that debt down and maybe just paying the minimum or the required balance on a student loan, which may have a much lower interest rate. So sort of thinking that plan through. A lot of families in this situation want to pay off all their debt, which is commendable. It's oftentimes hard on a tight budget. So given that those constraints, you know, you might want to focus most on the highest cost debt. There are other plans that we've seen. So, you know, Dave Ramsey has oftentimes said you should just focus on the smallest one because you get that one done and then you feel like you get somewhere. There's some logic to that. It makes people sort of emotionally feel like they're getting somewhere and making some progress, and I certainly wouldn't dispute that as a interesting way to help people think about these things. But, you know, in general, the economic analysis here would say pay off the highest cost one first, not the smallest one. So the next thing is to think a little bit about credit reports, and particularly FICO scores.
Hey, Michael, before you move off of the budget stuff, I've been hearing more in the news about frugal fatigue, and I'm kind of waiting for the big collective snap and splurge. And I don't know if you've been hearing anything about that.
I haven't, although it seems logical that at some point there's this sort of pent-up demand and then suddenly people start to give in and start to spend again.
I'm just thinking off the top of your head, do you know of any, like, economic indicators that people were doing that, like buying some of those pent-up things that they just couldn't, you know, sit on their hands anymore?
I haven't seen it. There are people who track, you know, like luxury goods, like high-end handbags or, you know, those kinds of things, the sort of splurge items.
I've heard of them.
Even vacations are another indicator. And I haven't seen anything suggesting that there's been a real uptick on that kind of stuff. But luxury goods have actually done relatively well in some sectors. in part because not everybody's hurting. But I haven't seen the sort of mass affluent, you know, luxury, any indicator that that market's sort of coming back a little bit. And when I say luxury goods, I don't mean like luxury, you know, like Donald Trump luxury, just, you know, goods, luxury goods are sort of the things that we think about that are sort of wants but not needs, you know, things like, I would argue, a high-end handbag. So.
I was thinking like Lindt chocolate as opposed to Aldi's chocolate.
Exactly. Yeah, it's good, better, more appropriate example for your budget.
And this is Ruth. I was thinking about eating out versus eating in.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, where you eat out and how frequently you eat out, those kinds of things. So I guess the short answer is I don't know. I haven't seen any data on that, although I think if we were starting to see that trend hit, we'd probably hear more about it in the popular press. Any other questions on the budgeting stuff? Again, I don't want to say that it's bad to, you know, occasionally eat out or to have those extras. And it's really a gauging whether you think the client's ready for it and whether they've built that into their budget or not.
And one of the things we talk about when I'm meeting with the people I see is, where is that going to put you in relation to your goal? And then they just have to decide. It's totally up to them because I like to eat out as much as the next person. But we just have to see where that puts you in terms of your family goals.
Right.
And then the decision is absolutely back on their shoulders.
Exactly. It's a good way to think about it. And again, starting with the goal. Goal is a good thing. I want to encourage people to interrupt with questions at any time or discussion. But I want to talk a little bit about credit and how people's credit responds to these kinds of negative events. I think this is a really interesting topic because the popular press has repeated some, I guess, press releases or information sourced from FICO, from the Fair Isaacs Corporation, which is responsible for creating the credit score that many lenders use, which are ultimately based on credit bureau data. But, you know, they've said that when people go through a foreclosure, I mean, typically what the data I've seen has been around foreclosure, their credit score drops, which you'd expect. This is a large item on their credit report, and when they stop paying on time on that, that should have a negative effect on the report. And if they stop paying on other things, that should have a negative impact on the credit report. So, and in fact, they would say that somebody who had a subprime credit score to begin with would lose about 85 points in their credit score, and if somebody who had a prime credit score, a good credit score, would lose like 160 points. So they have farther to fall because there is a floor in the FICO scoring system from a foreclosure. But then they also say that it's possible to recover back to whatever your pre-crisis level was, your pre-foreclosure level was, in as little as 2 years. And in fact, there's been other estimates that say as little as 18 months. And so this sort of caught, I think, a lot of researchers by sort of off guard, thinking, like, this can't be possible because a foreclosure sits on your credit record for 7 years, and it should really ding your ability to get future credit, and it seems like it should be more of a negative event. And it turns out that these estimates of 18 months or 24 months to recover to pre-crisis levels are true, but they're true based on the assumption of the thing that went wrong is that you were paying everything else on time. You're paying your credit card on time, your student loan, your car loan. You stopped paying your mortgage loan. You went into default. You went into delinquency. You went into foreclosure. You lost the house, or you did, you know, a slightly less harmful thing like a deed in lieu or, you know, some other alternative. But anyway, you still have this major derogatory on your credit report. You got out of the foreclosure, you got into renting, and you continued to pay everything else on time, and you no longer have any more derogatories. And in that world where people have their mistake, they recover from it, and then they, you know, immediately get back on track and don't make any more mistakes, it is true that it's possible to recover in as short as 18 months or 24 months to have a credit score that's back up again. Now, just because you have a credit score that's back up again doesn't mean that lenders will lend to you. For example, most lenders say no foreclosures in the last 3 years. Others say more foreclosures in the last 5 years. So getting a mortgage may not be possible, even though your credit score is up, but still having a higher credit score means better access to credit in other markets. So it certainly could be seen as a positive. And we also suspect that there's some lenders who are going to look back at your credit report and say, well, you have a good credit score now, you had a foreclosure in the past, but that was in that really unusual 2008, 2009, 2010 period. And, you know, we don't blame you too much because everybody got caught up in that now. So we'll kind of give you a pass. And if your credit score now is good, then we'll sort of look over that. So it's certainly possible.
Michael?
Yeah.
At a WIDA training I attended, their trainers said that even if you have a bankruptcy, if you are paying everything on time, your credit score does go up, but it's compared to everybody who's had a bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
And once you get tossed back into the general population mix, your credit score can actually go down again, if
yeah.
that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, because of the once you emerge from the bankruptcy itself.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah, bankruptcy is a little trickier because you do get it's a little lumpier, sort of. It, you know, people bob in and out as they get into their payment plan and get settled into that. But I think the same basic trend I'm about to talk about matters here too, which is, so if you play by all the rules, you go through the foreclosure, you pay, start paying everything on time, and then you never make a mistake again, you'll recover. It'll take you a little longer, and there'll be some ups and downs. But within, you know, I haven't seen the data that Fair Isaac has put out on this, but my guess is that, you know, it's going to be a little bit longer than foreclosure, but not a full 7 years. The problem is that when you look at actual data, and that's what the two graphs I show in here are from actual data that folks at the Federal Reserve, there's an economist at the Federal Reserve Board in Washington who actually bought credit bureau records for a sample of all people. And so they pulled out those people who went through a foreclosure, and you know, then they made these charts that you see here, which I'll explain in a second. But what they really tried to do is just find people before the foreclosure and after the foreclosure and look at their credit delinquencies. And, you know, by definition, they had at least one credit delinquency when the foreclosure started because they weren't paying their mortgage. But they oftentimes have other delinquencies, other items too. And so you can see from these charts that time zero is, that's the point when the foreclosure happened. And the different colored lines are the year that the foreclosure happened. So basically it's not a continuous, like, you know, 1990 through 2009 set of years. It's just, you know, each person's recalibrated so that zero is the date when they got their foreclosure, and then the line is what they did before and after foreclosure. And the different colored lines are what year that happened to them. So, you know, maybe for them, the foreclosure was in 2002 or 2003 or whatever. And so they were trying to get at, you know, are the really dark blue lines really different from the lighter blue lines, since the darker blue lines are people who've been in foreclosure just in 2009. But the basic trend here is that, you know, people are doing okay until about a year before the foreclosure, and then things start to get into trouble. And if you compare the all delinquencies, you can see at time zero, they're 100%, so they, you know, they at least had their mortgage delinquent. If you look at the other graph, that's just credit card delinquencies, and you'll see that they are about 60%. So at the time of foreclosure, you know, on average, about 60% of people had a credit card delinquency at the same time. So not everybody was defaulting on everything. But what's important is that in both of these arrows, the delinquency rate does not go to zero. So all delinquencies and credit card delinquencies both don't go to zero. In fact, even 5 years out, they're still looking at 30% delinquency rates on credit cards. And you know, we could do this. They, the paper, you could follow the link to this paper. They actually show it for a number of other different categories of borrowing. And this is the problem. It's not that it's not theoretically possible to recover from foreclosure or bankruptcy or everything else if you do everything right. But most people don't. That after going through these events, they continue to miss payments on credit cards, on whatever whatever it is out there. So, you know, even 7 years after, so after 7 years, the foreclosure is supposed to go away from the credit record. Credit scores are still 50 to 75 points below where they were pre-foreclosure. So, you know, basically, it comes down to credit management. It comes down to once you've had a problem, it's very hard to recover, and it's very hard to get back on your feet. And I think that's really where, you know, the work that you do and the, you know, the focus on goals, the focus on budgeting, the focus on spending plan, really reiterating that the ability to recover really is on how well people keep up with these bills, whether they keep paying credit card and other bills on time, because that's the major limiting factor in terms of credit score recovery, is not keeping up with other bills. You know, the mortgage may be wiped away by the foreclosure, but other expenses for credit card, student loan, auto loan, those kinds of things are still out there. And making those on time is really critical. Not making those on time will keep people at suppressed levels, and that's what you see in these graphs, are these high degree of suppressed scores even many years out from the foreclosure event. Now, like I said, we could probably replicate these for people going through bankruptcy or even an income drop. It's managing that overall balance sheet, which goes back to basic budgeting that's so important. You know, it's important to remember that unemployment, so a loss of income or a drop in income or a loss of a spouse's income, those are not in a credit report. So there are certainly people who've gone through, you know, even a 12-month spell of unemployment. Their income went from, you know, tens of thousands of dollars down to, you know, much less than that, and never missed a payment. And so their credit report would not be negatively affected. But that's not typically true. Oftentimes, once people have these income shocks, they have a hard time keeping up and they miss something, or they, you know, have some derogatory items on their credit reports. We can't really observe that in the credit bureau data, but we certainly, you know, see other defaults that might happen and see that, you know, sometimes it's highly correlated with overall unemployment rates, those kinds of things. So, you know, it's a different story for people who come out of an unemployment drop, or I'm sorry, a drop in income or an unemployment spell. But it's, you know, I think that same caveat applies, which is you have to have a spending plan and you have to be able to keep up with all these other bills. You know, the thing that's, I think, special about foreclosures for people, more than even bankruptcies to some extent, is that they are relatively public. They're in the public record, they're put in the newspaper, and the auction can oftentimes be a public event. And, you know, in some ways I think there's a perception at least that the foreclosure is worse than anything else, worse than a bankruptcy, worse than the kind of items. And I think there is a positive message here, which is that it's not true, that foreclosure isn't necessarily a 7 year sentence to not having good credit. It can recover if you pay attention to these other credit items and really stay on top of the overall spending plan. You know, as you think about working through credit, rebuilding credit with people, and again, this is part of the debtor education and other education that you all do, the same caveats apply. You know, paying on time is number one, and it's number one by a large margin. You know, really making sure you pay on time more than anything else. Outstanding balance does matter, and so, you know, oftentimes people do want to focus on the highest cost debt. That sometimes isn't the same as the largest piece of debt. And in some ways it doesn't matter because it's the overall outstanding balance that matters, and so paying down individual items is important. You know, sometimes people get worried about, well, I don't want to close accounts because that might hurt my credit report. And the truth is it does. If you close down accounts you've had for a long time and just keep recent accounts, it looks like you're just sort of a recent credit up buyer. But it's not a huge difference. I mean, you won't take a huge hit for doing that. And if you're already, you know, sort of in the tank for having a low score, having these negative events, it's really not the marginal effect of closing accounts is kind of minimal. So certainly applying for credit for people in this situation is something that should be approached very cautiously. You know, now, if you need a car loan and you're seeking multiple car loans in a 30-day period, that's great. That doesn't count as multiple applications. That counts for sort of one shopping around experience. We want to encourage people to do that. They shouldn't not shop around. But looking for a car loan this month and then a credit card loan in 2 months and another loan in 2 months, that suggests to the credit bureau that this is somebody who's trying to get back, you know, back into the credit markets in full force before they've really cleaned up what they've got. And so that can't be a derogatory. You know, obviously the older items are worse. So as time goes on, those negatives are weighed less and less and less. It's much more important to pay your bills on time today than to worry about a judgment that's, you know, 6 or 7 years old. You know, one strategy I think that you all know about and we've heard a lot about is to do automatic payments. That, you know, getting people banked once they have a regular income, get at least the minimum balance paid automatically every month so that it's not and get it paid before the due date, so that it's not a race to you know, see what's left at the end of the month, and then the lender gets that, but to really try to make sure that paying down those bills becomes a high priority. Obviously, other kinds of debt that people might have that might not be in the credit report are important, too, like back utility bills. You know, for anybody who's maybe been on any of the seasonal plans to try to skip payments in the winter, that would certainly hit. But just, you know, accrued back utility bills. Payday loans is another category, which wouldn't be in the credit report, but you know, obviously high cost and something to focus on paying down. You know, credit cards, as I said before, really looking at the higher cost items and trying to make a budget to get that down. Closing accounts, as I said, isn't necessarily a bad idea. Sometimes people feel really good about getting rid of accounts. There's a sense of, you know, those guys, I made some mistakes, those guys got me, I'm mad at those guys, I want to get rid of that account. I want to get away from that firm, whoever sold me that card. And that's fine. Like I said, I don't think that getting, you know, rid of older accounts is necessarily that bad if you already have bad credit anyway. And remember that, you know, they could say, well, I had a lot of trouble with that card, so I'll close it. It still sits on the credit report. It's not like it goes away just because you get rid of, cancel the card or no longer use the card. As I said before, when we're thinking about new credit, you know, it's important to encourage people to shop around and not say, well, I shouldn't apply for multiple car loans, for example, because I don't want it to negatively affect my credit score. You know, any application within a 30-day period would be considered all one application. So it's certainly not something you want to discourage people from doing, shopping around. We always tell people to, if somebody's offering you credit unsolicited, whether it's, you know, to get 10% off your Walmart purchase or Target purchase or whatever it is, or, you know, as a door-to-door solicitation or in the mail or on the street or in the airport, generally a bad idea. It's a bad idea because you can't really shop around. It's a bad idea because you won't really pay attention to all the details. You know, and oftentimes the cost of those cards far exceeds whatever that minimum discount or other incentive was. So that's the credit section. Let me pause there and see if anybody has any thoughts or questions.
Well, I guess I was thinking about those charts that you have in your handout. And I was just really surprised to see how much credit delinquency there is following a foreclosure. And I was thinking about when we were doing the bankruptcy counseling and how many of the people we saw were homeowners but were going to recommit to their home loan. And I was just wondering if the credit is that bad for all those people going through a foreclosure, I wonder why they aren't going through bankruptcy at the same time. I was wondering what, like, the ratio is of that.
So there is a correlation. It's higher in some states than others of people who face foreclosure and bankruptcy, but they're really two separate things. As you know, the bankruptcy doesn't help people really in foreclosure, other than it frees up maybe other cash flow to pay the mortgage if they want to stick with the mortgage. So the bankruptcy itself really is targeted at other kinds of debt. I think the main reason we haven't seen, we've certainly seen a rise in, a simultaneous rise in foreclosures and bankruptcies. With the new rules on Chapter 13, it's just a restructuring of the debt. For people who might qualify for Chapter 7, it might make sense to get rid of some of this debt. And if you're already, you know, you're already in foreclosure or losing on the foreclosure, the extra, you know, negative of going through bankruptcy might not be that significant. But, you know, we had a big boom of people filing before the changes in the Bankruptcy Reform Act in 2005, and I think there's a number of people who may have taken advantage of it then and are in trouble again and can't, because of the way the rules are, can't necessarily do another Chapter 7. And then the Chapter 7 rules, particularly in some states, are such that it may not make sense to do Chapter 7, which leaves people more with a debt restructuring. We have seen people in foreclosure doing debt management plans, DMPs. In some ways, that gives them a shorter-term version of what you get in Chapter 13, maybe not quite as intensive in the renegotiation on repayment amounts. But, you know, I'd also say we don't exactly know yet, because the bankruptcy data have been trending upwards, and it may be that it's going to really start to jump up as we see more people facing, particularly underwater foreclosures where they might be facing a deficiency or, you know, those kinds of things where, you know, they really need to restructure their whole portfolio. And maybe their income now is, the income and assets are depleted so much that a Chapter 7 is a possibility. Or they've, you know, gotten past the time limits on refiling. So we may, in fact, see what you suggest, which is more of this tandem bankruptcy foreclosure trend. But, you know, right now it's been foreclosure first and bankruptcy sort of rising, but not quite at the same rate.
And a second question, too. So I know we've heard a lot about the foreclosure prevention mediation that, you know, people are doing different things with. Did they ever have any discussion about having a mandated financial education following foreclosure, kind of like they put in place for bankruptcy?
For loan modifications under the Home Affordable Mortgage Program, or HAMP, they did at one point require a mortgage counseling, a default counseling session for people who had a debt-to-income ratio over 50%. I've seen nothing on how that's been implemented. We know that just if you compare the number of modifications to the number of people counseled, it looks like about a third of modifications include some kind of counseling. But we haven't seen a whole lot of detail on what that looks like. And it typically is not related to the foreclosure, but rather the modification or the attempt to get a modification. So it's not so clear, you know, what people do after foreclosure and what sort of help they get at that point in time. Now, there are states that have done either a, certainly there's some states and localities that have done mediation, which is a little different because that's just a third party getting parties down to the table. And some have said either pre-mediation or as part of the foreclosure process, the borrower has to go through either an education or a counseling session. And again, I don't know how thoroughly that's been implemented. I know like parts of New York and Long Island have implemented, some counties there, some other places, but how thoroughly that's been done, I don't know. Unfortunately, not great data on the way these programs have actually been rolled out. All right, and I'm happy to go back to the credit questions at the end. I hope those charts help. I thought they were kind of nifty because it was real data and not just conjecture from the company. So a little bit about emergency funds. As I said in the beginning, I think that while many would say it doesn't make sense to build up an emergency fund that earns basically zero interest when you have 23% credit card loans, I can't argue with that logic. But I think there is a behavioral aspect to building an emergency fund that is important to how people think about, and it's okay if we're talking about saving a small amount of money because it's building the habit, getting that moving. I think the key is to find, you know, a savings vehicle that's low cost or no cost that people can have, particularly to cover an emergency expense. A lot of times in economics, I talk about precautionary savings, which is, you know, savings for the next time I lose my job. That's probably unrealistic for most families. I mean, because that means savings of you know, 3 or 4 months income. And, you know, that's certainly a goal. And, you know, a lot of financial planners now say you should have 6 months savings, liquid savings in case you face a job loss. But I think it's probably more important for most people to have a smaller sum of money, say $500, in case their car breaks down or an appliance breaks down or some unforeseen expense that they face in the short run, and have that in a fairly liquid form. So, you know, a CD or a checking, I'm sorry, a savings account, something that is a little bit hard to reach, but accessible when the time comes. So I think this is an important piece of the puzzle. Emergency savings is something that a lot of people put off, or they tap before the real emergency comes. You know, they, oh, it's an emergency, I need to go out to eat. So really helping people think through about the idea of an emergency fund and, you know, what if your car breaks down or that kind of thing. And then as soon as they use it, to make sure they start about refunding it again. That prevents people from maybe needing a payday loan or a title loan or other kinds of products, or borrowing from friends and family. So I think these are important, important tools to talk about with people.
Hey, Michael, just a couple of weeks ago when I was doing a work and wheels session on the second unit that we've been asked to do by Southwest Cap is crisis spending, and the same line that you just used, you just put a little bit away, a little bit away, a little bit away, and then if you need to use it, start again putting it away. I've been really surprised when I ask the question, what would be a time when you feel the need to have to tap into that reserve or tap into that crisis account or the rainy day fund? And one of the people I had in just a couple of weeks ago said, well, we needed to do laundry. And I think my jaw really hits the table, and I'm usually really good at that. But for that family, that was a need. And certainly not anything that's ever been on my radar or been on my list of examples that I've used before. But for that family at that time, getting the laundry done was a need and qualified as a legitimate use of the rainy day fund.
Yeah.
So I guess, once again, it's up to each individual.
Right. I mean, I think to some extent, I just was doing some writing on this idea of emergency funds and how we think about them. To some extent, you can help people think about, what are the things that you can expect to have to spend money on every month or so? And so you would think that most people might predict that laundry would be one of those items. Maybe not new clothes, but, you know, the cost of running a load of laundry, sort of general maintenance kind of stuff. What people are, I think, particularly, so, and then people are okay at thinking about, well, there's this long-term things I got to save for, like education and retirement, but I'll get to that some other time. What they're really hard at is these sort of short-term, relatively predictable, but not exactly when kind of items. So you know at some point your car is going to need a repair, but you don't know when, so you don't, it's not part of your budget. So I would, to the extent you can help people think about reoccurring, very predictable expenses like laundry, I think that helps them build that into their regular budget.
Yeah, that's. I guess I thought we were there, but clearly we weren't.
They hadn't gotten that far yet.
It is. Yeah, then we need to go back and review lesson one.
Right.
The regular, even though it might not be an every week thing or an every pay period thing, it's still a regular thing that happens.
Right. And to some extent, you could say the same thing about car repairs. It's just not as dependable when it's going to happen. You might get lucky, and it might not happen this year at all. Or this might be a bad year, and which I experienced, you know, both the tires and something major has to get done. So, I think people are really hard at that, at those, you know, relatively big, relatively lumpy kinds of things that will happen, but are, you know, exactly when is not for sure. You know, I won't say a whole lot about retirement savings. Certainly anybody who's cashed out a retirement account or taken a loan against a retirement account, that's something to address. Financial security in retirement is still possible, particularly if people are relatively young. If they ended up using their retirement accounts later in life for one of these negative trigger events, it's hard. And so helping people really think through what their expectations might be for retirement and, you know, if this is something that they see as a goal to really put money away for retirement, you know, that's something they really have to think through, and what are they willing to sacrifice today to make that happen? Because it's going to be very hard to have a tight budget, pay off debt, high cost debt, and also put away money for retirement. obviously, taking advantage of any retirement options at work that are free, you know, to the extent there might be matching or other things at work, certainly explore those with people, but, you know, you're lucky, I guess, if you find people in that situation. A little bit about deficiencies and judgments. You know, I won't go too far into this because we did another brief, was it last month? Recently. In the last couple of months, we did a brief on this whole issue of legal issues of judgment, garnishments, deficiencies, those kinds of things. You know, but basically, it's very important for people to understand what they're subject to. Many people know that they have something. They can't exactly describe it well, but they are being garnished or at risk of being garnished because of something like this. So in most cases, it's just a matter of helping people understand what their situation is. Are they through the garnishment process? Are they in the court now? Are they being threatened with it? Sort of what's the state of the world? You know, some people who are in garnishment or facing judgments may avoid bank accounts because they worry about garnishment or about an account being frozen, possibility. You know, in general, if it's, you know, there's certain kinds of income that are exempt from garnishment, and again, that's covered in the prior brief, but, you know, it's oftentimes just helping people understand the terms and understand the situation. You know, obviously, much of this gets into the legal process, and for somebody who's actually facing a court hearing on a judgment or garnishment, then they should get that support and don't try to play that role. You know, the last thing I would say is that, unfortunately, there are individuals and firms out there who are very tuned in to the needs of people who are recovering from a financial setback. So, you know, the agency or the company or the salesman who says, I can make all your credit problems go away, I can erase your bad credit, I can make your creditors give up their claims and, you know, write off any loans against you. You know, I think these are quite just egregious right now to be able to really reach out to folks in the market. Are you know, how they sort of live with themselves, I think, is an open question. But in any case, anytime you see a recession, you see the scam artists coming out, and we're seeing that now. So the credit repair agencies are a big one. They are not nonprofit; they are for profit, and they say they're going to settle your debt for a fee. And those kinds of things, I think, are a real scam to be careful of. Oftentimes, people will get offers by mail for more credit, which is remarkable, but you can imagine what the cost of that credit probably looks like. When I wrote this, I was thinking about mail, but I've learned more recently about the flood of internet-based credit filings as well as, creditors that might be based offshore or on a, you know, native reservation who can, who aren't restrained by the same kinds of loan regulations that other firms are. And so, you know, you'll see these offers of pretty high cost loans that are offered over the internet or by mail. We can't really get people to opt out of the internet, but you can opt out of unsolicited credit offers with the phone numbers and website I show here. You know, collections, again, this is something we talked a bit about on the call the last time, but there are some ways to deal with collectors who are being abusive. Just because you've gone through foreclosure or any of these other events doesn't mean the collectors will stop hounding you. Even if you're on time now, they may be trying to get past unpaid items. And so, you know, again, this gets into some legal issues, but there is some information in the previous brief, and then there's some phone numbers and websites here to look at to help people determine whether this is really harassment and to file a complaint if it might be harassment. So again, just to conclude, I think the overall story here is that it is very possible to recover from negative financial setbacks, whether it's a job loss, foreclosure, bankruptcy, these kinds of things. Now, I'm saying recover financially. There are certainly social and other effects that you all know a lot about, with effects on kids or schooling. Families do recover. There's more and more research there's a study I just saw recently of kids in New York City schools who've gone through foreclosure, and you know they're actually pretty resilient, and they do seem to come back and to make a go of it. And it's certainly possible to rebuild faster than you might assume. But it all assumes having a plan, having goals, having a budget, sticking to a budget, and paying all those bills on time. It's the lack of that sort of taking the next steps after this negative event that really keeps people back. I think this is a key teachable moment. It's a hard moment to reach people, but it is a moment where I think you can have really profound effects. And, you know, if you think about those lines on those credit charts that I shared from the Federal Reserve, and you see that a lot of people still struggle even years after the event. So helping people get a fresh start and, you know, really get those delinquencies down and get a good budget, get a stable income, probably can make a big difference in their ability to recover over the long term. I'll end there unless anybody has any questions or comments.
I just have a question. When you were talking about garnishments and judgments, and I know you talked about this in February, but I can't remember if we touched on it. And I was thinking about the May 1st conversion of federal benefits, that they have to receive them electronically. And I was thinking of if people have their federal dollars in a savings account, I think it's the first $1,000 that's exempt from garnishment. Is that correct?
That
comes from a federal...
That sounds right according to my
okay.
my faulty memory, although I'll say banks just freeze the whole thing oftentimes, and that's why people are leery about using an account at all.
Okay. And because I was thinking of if they have if people have money in, they start putting money in a savings account and it's not from federal benefits, there's no, limit for what's exempt.
Right.
Okay. But banks go ahead and freeze the whole thing anyway.
Yeah, banks generally don't want to get into a dispute about what it is or isn't, so they just freeze the whole thing, and then they figure the court will settle it out and tell them what to do. So you can argue with the bank about that, but generally they just don't want to get involved, so they just freeze the whole account. It's not the most used consumer-friendly practice.
Yeah, and I could see a lot of people not wanting to build up their emergency savings by putting it in a bank, and they don't want to put it in, a prepaid debit card because monthly fees. So, I've met with...
Well, so if you're thinking about the movement to electronic payment of benefits, there will be this debit card that Treasury issues that doesn't have the fees. But all it does is get you that monthly benefit.
I guess I was thinking about a place for people to save money.
Yeah.
Rainy day fund.
Yeah.
So I do have somebody who I work with who receives federal benefits who just has it electronically deposited and uses it to make automatic payments and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I guess I was saying I've met with a lot of people who just are keeping their money in safe.
Yeah.
You know, that nobody knows about but them and me.
Right.
And now everybody listening to this call.
Right. No, it's definitely been an issue that's come up a lot lately as we move to electronic benefits payments, sort of how that can affect people who really are on a cash basis. So I think it's a very good point.
Michael, this is Shelley. Do you see people becoming unbanked because of these reasons? Who've always been banked?
So that this is a research that some folks have looked at using the FDIC unbanked and underbanked survey from 2009, and they divide people into two categories. One are the never banked, and the other are the previously banked. And for that previously banked population, a lot of it had to do with costs and convenience, or unpredictable costs was probably a piece of it. We don't see a whole lot of the data about issues about garnishment. But when I talk to counselors, this always comes up, that people, you know, they have access to a free account or, you know, a special subsidized account through the city or through some program, and yet they're afraid of having it because they're worried about judgments or garnishment. So I think it's definitely a confound that particularly for, vulnerable populations, people in credit-deprived communities might really face in a more extreme way. Any other questions or comments? I think this issue of the movement to electronic benefits is a really important one, and maybe something for me to put on a future lunchtime learning agenda call. And I'm always welcome for new ideas, too, even though we're going to half as many lunchtime learning calls. Any hot topics that you want to delve into, I'm happy to. So just shoot me an email if you do. All right. Thanks, everybody. Have a great week.